The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy, an Orthodox priest, and a theorist of nationalism and agrarianism. And now, here's Matt.
Welcome back, everybody, to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. Today is October 18th, 2011. It is my 40th birthday today. And one of the big problems of reaching this age, but I think for a lot of my listeners, I'm fairly young. I get the impression that my listeners are older. I could be wrong about that. But as I get older, there's a few things that are happening. I'm losing patience with the pedestrian mentality in politics and history. This is a real problem largely because it's not harmless. This sort of thing is not a hobby. This kind of thing is not something that you should be doing to because you need to prove to the world that you're smart. You could do a lot of damage. And if you go through the blogs and you see people, some of whom have good intentions and some of whom have very bad intentions, spreading a lot of rumors and half-truths, not necessarily because they're deliberately manipulating people, but they simply don't know any better. And I tell you something, these 40 years today, and there's one thing about our social life that I've learned, and that's really going to be on my tombstone one day as an epitaph, and that's this simple phrase, this simple sentence, and I want you to think about it in great detail and depth. You do not have a right to an opinion on a topic about which you know little or nothing. That statement, in a lot of very important ways, summarizes the epistemology of Plato. It summarizes a lot of the semi-aristocratic approach to these disciplines. You know, when I first got into this field, about 21 years ago, I spent, you know, I haven't taken a vacation. Because even when I do go away or do something that's supposed to be fun, you know, I bring all my books with me. I never stop thinking about these things, which is a good thing and a terrible thing in many ways. I spent the last 20 years suffering greatly, not just in the consequences of talking like this in the regime and the evil that controls us, but that, you know, in coming up with even a tentative opinion on, let's say, the political thought of James Madison or something in Western Europe, Napoleon, the French Revolution, you know, you're talking about 10 solid full-time years minimum, in my opinion, of going over the massive, almost ridiculously massive amount of material out there. And then maybe you can have a very tentative opinion that you put forth with great trepidation. If there's anything, you know, when somebody is talking about a topic, very important topic, very complicated topic, they think they know a few things, they've read a couple of books about it, and they think they know something. They have no idea what they're missing. They have no idea the amount of material that you need to go through, even for a tentative opinion. And I'm saying 10 years minimum, and that's as a full-time occupation. And when I was in grad school and afterwards and at the Barnes Review and places like this, I lost a lot of sleep because I needed to solve certain problems. who was right in the 19th century, say, the Russian Empire or Ukraine? Which makes more sense from our point of view, an empire or a strong nation state? These kind of questions, I lost sleep, and let me tell you too, I've lost friends and even family members over these issues. And the amount of material, the tens of thousands of pages, whether it be in English or in Russian or Ukrainian or Serbian, that I poured through, and the amount of time, I mean, you know, what I lost, the occupations that I couldn't do, the attacks that I've come under by the professional academics for even bringing up some of these topics in the way that we do, and going through this ridiculously massive amount of material that the amateurs out there don't even know exists, never mind has ever been through. And 20 years of this, nonstop, pretty much 365 days a year, and that level of intensity and constant reading and constant writing and constant talking with professors and other experts and trying to ask the right questions and getting everything together and really developing almost an obsession, almost a pathological condition, going over this stuff for this many years in a relatively specialized field, you will pardon me if I get a little snippy when some punk writes me who's read a couple of books on this and is going to start lecturing me on it. It's one of the few times, you know, I'm going to clock somebody if they're in front of me. If you're not a bona fide expert on a topic, either you have the education, you have the publications, you have all the years you got to put in to even come up with a tentative opinion on these topics, and especially topics like the British Empire or the French Revolution or the unification of Germany. I mean, these are the amount of material, you couldn't shoot through it. You could build a house with just the English language material on this topic. Please shut up if you haven't been through all of it or most of it. You don't know. You have no idea what you might be missing, what you haven't come across. And one of the things that I've learned in these 40 years now, 20 full-time years, you know, I've never had a normal job. As a teenager I did, but this is what I've done full-time since I was 18. When you simply don't know, and you go out and you're on these stupid blogs and you're trying to, you know, say something, you know what, and if you make an error, and often I'm saying we all make errors, but I'm talking about serial stuff where, you know, you're coming up with theories that are contradicted by facts that you don't know exist because you haven't been through the material and the years it takes to get through it all and the suffering that it takes. This isn't something, you know, you just don't read after dinner because, you know, it's relaxing. This is something that you do and it's painful sometimes. You're constantly suffering through these problems. I used to wake up at 2 a.m, run to my desk and go through, you know, a ton of, because I have some inspiration on a particular topic. I mean, this is how you live. This is a lifestyle that you choose. It's not a hobby. It's not something that you people decide to do because it makes you seem smart or you think this is going to impress someone or you're going to change the world or you're going to be a leader or you want to make a couple of bucks. You know, this is not what this is for. And when you get on these blogs and you see this crap, just pure factual absurdity. They just don't. And, you know, think of a young student, high school, early college, and they're going through this and they start believing some of this stuff is true. You're poisoning the atmosphere. You're poisoning the debate when you inject this kind of ignorance and extreme amateurism into these things. You could do a lot of damage. And you could hurt a lot of people because if they believe some of this is true and they go spouting it, they're going to sound like morons. I think one of the great arguments, and this is stuff, you know, what I'm talking to you about right now, this is, goes right to the core of modernity, of liberal democracy, of this kind of so-called open debate, And, you know, the old liberal concept from, you know, John Milton to John Stuart Mill was that if you have open debate on a topic and everyone's involved and everyone's spreading their opinion, what will happen eventually is that the true opinions will eventually defeat the false ones, and the false ones will fall away, and the true ones will remain. That's the argument for the so-called liberal democracy that we live under. Now, no one believes it's true, nor do I believe that the people who wrote this stuff believed it was true. They had other agendas. Because it assumes, number one, that everyone's rational. It assumes, number two, that everyone has good intentions. It assumes, number three, that the only reason that people want to discuss these things is to get to the truth. And it assumes, number four, that the truth will win out, and then that people, at least over time, will abandon the false idea. These assumptions are wild. They have no evidence behind them. They are mere rhetoric. And it's not easy to talk like this. I don't like talking like this, but I don't care. This is part of my professional responsibility, like it or not. But the fact remains that the overwhelming majority of people come to this field, or really, you know, any of these things that you know, try to sound smart and knowledgeable, they come to this field because of irrationality. Overwhelmingly, I'm dealing with people, and I know a lot of my listeners have experienced this in their own life, that are not interested in the facts of the case. It's not that they have an incorrect point of view. It's just that point of view isn't even meant to be true. It's meant to be useful for them. And this is something that I'm coming across in a lot of debates that I'm having in the religious realm. This is especially the case with women, far more than men, at least in my experience, that these kind of quote-unquote spiritual approaches to the world have no basis in fact. They have no basis, even in the experience of the great saints and mystics of the past. And I realize that when I'm debating these people, and it's very easy to do, it's almost like I'm toying with them, I'm realizing that the truth of the matter is totally irrelevant. What they want is something that will make them feel better about the world. They want to feel better about themselves. They have this cognitive conflict that the regime says that we're all free individuals and we're all free to do what we want. And modernity and technology is going to, you know, usher us into an age of peace and prosperity. The Enlightenment is based on that concept. Everyone knows it's false. Everyone knows that every single promise has been broken. Many of them have just been abandoned. They're not empowered. They're not individuals. They certainly are not unique. Everything that's been fed to them by the regime is a lie. Or, more accurately, is a half-truth or a quarter-truth. The regime just can't lie through its teeth. That doesn't make any... You know, that's not how it works. You have to mix in some truth with it in order to be credible. The point of it all is that people come, whether it be theology or history or philosophy, it's not about getting to the truth and suffering for it. It's about appearing a certain way. It's about sounding intellectual. It's about supporting your own class status, supporting political ideology to justify your position in the world. Facts aren't relevant. Facts, in order to be facts, have to be contextualized. They have to be a part of an overarching approach to the world. Facts just don't sit around. Facts are never individual. In fact, nothing is ever individual. It's all contextualized. But even something like that, even a concept like that, is far beyond the mentality of the average American, the average TV watcher, the average suburbanite. And of course, it probably shouldn't be. What I do and what some of you do is a highly technical, very difficult field. It has its own vocabulary, has its own methodologies, much of which is completely lost on the average person. But of course, I could say the same thing for my car mechanic, who, you know, I'm incompetent in that area. I know that, and so I'm not going to go marching into the garage and start telling him what to do. But that is, in essence, what people do when they're talking about extremely complicated fields, international political economy, and all of the variables that you have to weigh and measure and define with precision before you could even begin to develop opinions, never mind actually have an opinion, and never mind even defending that opinion. It's not a hobby. It's not something that you do to pass the time. And the real damage is done. I saw it at the university. I see it everywhere I go. This stuff gets spouted for some self-interested reason, and falsehood is spread as truth. It can really do a tremendous amount of damage. You know, if you beat somebody up, those wounds will heal. If you brainwash somebody, those wounds, chances are, will never heal. Deprogramming somebody is a lifelong struggle in a lifelong battle. So this, to me, is very, very important. And I'm not going to respond to a lot of these people who pretend to know something and who they send me these things and they write me these emails on issues and they're citing all these facts and authors and they think they're giving me some kind of revelation. You know, I read them my freshman year in college. What you think is revelation to guys who do this full time is nothing. It's second nature. And so you develop this kind of presumption, you develop this kind of pretension, and one of these days I'm just going to forget it and I'm going to withdraw entirely because I'm realizing that debate, for the most part, is useless because you're not really talking with someone who cares about whether or not their point of view is true. They care about whether their point of view satisfies some other requirement, emotional or financial or personal. People believe what they want. People who comment on my radio shows and other radio shows, people on this network and others, they say things, and I'm reading these, and I can't. They couldn't possibly have listened to the show, or if they did, they only heard what they want, or they only heard what they understood. So this is a huge issue for me. This is a big deal for me. And a lot of very serious damage can be done. But the political and philosophical punchline to all of this is that it completely annihilates and destroys and crumbles the pseudo-philosophical foundation of the modern world. Because this kind of modern liberal democracy, and I want to drop most of the Federalists and Anti-Federalists in America because they were so Roman in their approach to things. Really, Jefferson was really the only huge Enlightenment-style figure, and even he deviated from that pretty regularly. But the concept was that, in general, modernity is based on this notion that truth will win out, that bad ideas will fall away because they're exposed as falsehoods, and the result of all of this is that our knowledge will continue to progress. And that's what all of this, whether you're utilitarian or you believe in natural rights or whether you believe in these kind of, you know, Republican style, Florentine, Italian, city-state style approaches to political debate and political discussion, all of it is rendered completely fraudulent by the simple fact that most people, if not the overwhelming majority of people, are not motivated by this abstract desire for truth. Plato talked about this erotic longing for the forms, for the reality beyond space and time that contains the truths of our world, but just in a pure and unchanging way. That there is a drive for that that cannot be put into words. There's a drive for that that separates the ascetic philosopher from the common run of people. The common run of people in Plato's world were represented by the sophists. These were essentially the university professors of their day. And in fact, Socrates goes after them with great intensity because they were this very, they were not unintelligent people, but they were extremely convinced of their own mission to teach the young, and as it turns out, they're doing this because they're charging money. They're telling people what they want to hear. They don't believe in truth. They believe only in utility, social usefulness of any particular fact. This is the common run of your university professors and media hacks. They're doing what they're doing because it's not a bad gig. Certainly beats working in a factory. So Socrates spent a huge portion of his career destroying the pretensions of these people. Christ at the same time, and people forget about this, the scribes and the so-called scholars of the law were these men who had, they wore special clothing. They wore special robes that designated them as scribes and scholars, and they were very pompous, and they were usually very well off. Christ went after them with intensity. Now, Socrates and Christ had that same mission. The mission is that there is a desire for truth, because our souls can only be satisfied with that which is unchanging, which is the forms taken together are, so to speak, the mind of God. And Plato was not adverse to that kind of language. And of course, but there is a sophist. There is the scribe. There are careerists. They have conformed to the corporate culture. It's not about getting to the truth. It's about justifying themselves, their position, society, whatever it is. There are no facts. There's only power. And Plato's Gorgias, one of my favorite Platonic dialogues of all time, because it's dedicated to this topic that I've spent 20 minutes talking about now. It's short, it's of immense profundity, because Socrates, and of course Plato, who's writing this all down, has no patience for that sophistic pretentiousness, and Christ says the same thing, more or less, to the scribes and scholars of the law, who he mocks because they wear their hair in a certain way, and they wear their specially colored robes, and they love to walk in the marketplace with all of these phony students around them. But of course, you know, these guys were also very well paid. Jesus was paid nothing. Socrates was paid nothing. All right. We will talk some more. We are at the midpoint of the show, and we'll return here in a minute.
Don't go away, because there is more on the Orthodox Nationalist. This is VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, hosted by Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. I spent the first 20 minutes of the show really talking about the foundations of the fraud of modernity, specifically the creation of liberal democracy. And the point I wanted you to take from all of this, and I spoke at least to some extent from my own personal experience of what happens when ignorant people, I say ignorant as opposed to stupid. Stupid implies that you really can't learn. You don't have that capacity. Ignorant just means that you just don't know about a subject. I'm ignorant about car repair. I'm ignorant about, artificial fertilizer. I mean, these things I know nothing about. But if I needed to, I could learn about them. A stupid person just can't learn. He just doesn't have the IQ. He doesn't have that conceptual apparatus that could allow him to process information. It's ignorant people that are the problem. And really the payoff of it all is that, you know, having this so-called public debate, which, you know, first of all, is controlled by the regime, it's controlled by media. It's controlled by public relations firms. It's controlled by wealthy and powerful and exclusively leftist universities. So, I mean, liberal democracy is a fraud to begin with. I mean, even if you accept the idea that somehow truth will always will out and people only have that motivation, or in general have that motivation, the fact that debates have always been tightly circumscribed. by powerful institutions, and that powerful institutions promoted modernity and political liberalism and continue to do so, that's enough to destroy the theory. And that's true. I mean, that's all true. But my particular concern today, and it's been particularly acute, I think, over the last year, I think it has something to do with the uncertainty in the environment. People can't believe that the empire is falling. They were led to believe that the American empire is eternal. History is over. The U.S. And the neocons and Obama are the final manifestations of historical truth. And I'm actually getting, you know, emails claiming all of this by otherwise, you know, intelligent people. It's simply quite skillful Pavlovian brainwashing and conditioned responses and studied responses. It's one cliche strung onto another one. And these people believe that they are promoting something profound. And what makes matters, I mean, not only does this really poison the debate, not only does this destroy people because they begin believing this stuff, they begin building their entire intellectual edifice around this garbage. And somebody who otherwise could have been a good, solid activist is now a cliche spouting idiot because of what they read from some of these people. So to think that, you know, writing these comments and these blog things and even writing papers of your own and stuff like that, that can't do damage, that's false. It can do damage. I've seen it happen. University professors are the worst because they have this authority, but they are completely conformist in adopting the liberal corporate culture. And what otherwise could have been excellent scholars are twisted and mutilated. And then they do the same to their students, who are a captive audience. You people are listening to this because you want to. Students go to a university lecture because they have to. And to have university professors have these very complicated attendance policies. You know, if you miss two classes, your grade goes down by one. If you miss three classes, yeah, they have these long attendance policies. And it's got to dawn on them. It's got to dawn on them at one point or another that, you know, these students don't want to be here. They don't want to listen to you. The very fact that you have to write these long, detailed attendance policies shows that they don't want to be there. So how any university professor can take his own job seriously? But of course, at the same time, they have an excellent gig. They work 8 months out of the year. They teach two classes a semester on average. Usually those classes are something that they've taught over and over again, so it's no work. Half the time when they're in the classroom, they're not lecturing. They are playing movies. They're showing slides and PowerPoints. They're putting up all kinds of computer-generated graphics. This is in my field. History, philosophy, political science, economics. I don't know about biology and stuff like that. I simply don't know. But in my field, that's really how it is. They don't work. They write something on occasion, and they write something, again, not because they really want to. They're doing it because sometimes it's a requirement, but they also have to show to their deans and to the institution that they are adding lines to their vita. And there's a lot of articles and books out there that are called vita books. They exist only because a professor had to throw something together to get a line on a vita, because they don't want the dean or the chairman breathing down their neck, you have to do these things. And the fact that this garbage gets through this completely fraudulent peer review system will always be a mystery to me. Peer review, for those of you who don't know, it's a stupid idea. If you write a paper for a journal, you send it to the editor. The editor then sends a copy without your name or institution to a reviewer, usually one, sometimes two. This person will usually skim the paper, write a couple of comments, and send it back. The editor doesn't necessarily have to listen to it. He can publish it anyway. But usually what happens is that the paper is returned to the professor with the reviewer's comments. Now, it's a stupid system. Number one, the reviewer is totally anonymous. He could say whatever he wants, and there's no responsibility for his actions. Number two, in my experience, peer reviewers are idiots. They skim the pieces. They don't read them. And when they make comments, it's usually completely irrelevant. Or they have simply imposed their own particular view of the topic on you. And half the time, it's really writing for the sake of writing. So that explains why there is so much garbage and so much mythology upon mythology that is published as if this is some kind of profound revelation to the world. And these concepts like, you know, Mill's idea of liberal democracy, which I mentioned already, that somehow this is true, that people are equal in these regards anyway, without any, not a shred of scientific evidence or any kind of evidence that that happens to be the case. This mythology, it comes from intellectual laziness. The fact remains that most university professors are very soft intellectually, and that is because they don't have any real debate. You generally don't talk shop with each other unless there's a very specific issue happening in the department that's very much frowned on. You don't really discuss issues. And you go into the classroom and you have a captive audience. And my experience, you know, universities all over this country has been awful. A lot of these people simply don't know. And they don't have to know. They know enough to go into a classroom and say what they got to say. They know enough to put together a paper on occasion. They may travel to a conference, always paid for by somebody else. These people don't have to pay for anything. Everything is paid for. And that's pretty much it. Occasionally you get someone who's really into a certain area and they become very knowledgeable and it's interesting. But in general, that's not the case. And you have such a massive inflation of university professors right now. There are tens of thousands of these people. They're being generated en masse. It is a mass production of these people. And of course, affirmative action rules. A woman or a non-white is guaranteed a job. They get put to the front of the line whether they know anything or not. And these are the people who are, you know, teaching your kids. You come out of a university, unless it's a technical field, like, you know, a biology or chemistry, where, you know, you really can't manipulate formula. But in the humanities and the social sciences, it's all manipulated. And students come out thinking that they're educated, but it is a pure presumption on their part. They have been initiated. They have not been educated. My critique of the academic world is very well known. And it's really, it's based on the following considerations. The hiring practices are not based on ability. There is no even mention of teaching. It's about being able to fit in to the department and to how the university works. Complete conformity to the corporate culture, that's very well known. Their average pay is always in the six figures, but that takes a while to get there. For very little work. And then it doesn't include if their sabbatical years where they could actually leave, get paid either half or even in some cases their full salary and do absolutely nothing for a year. They're supposed to be doing some kind of research, but there is no clear requirement on that. And I have former friends who went on sabbatical years ago, and I'm still waiting for the results of what they were supposed to be doing. It's based on foundation grants. If you want to be a big name, being a big name in the field means that you attract as much foundation money as possible. It's highly stereotyped and formulaic writing. Writing an academic paper is simply following a template. A trained monkey could do it. It's not scholarship. It isn't meant to be scholarship. And people forget that the academics, when they decide on policy, meet, and they meet in secret. No one is allowed to be there. No one is allowed to record it. Students, parents, none of these people are permitted, and it is simply amongst the academics, and they chart the course of the university. And these people receive mountains of tax money to do this. Americans are supposed to be suffering, and yet universities are drowning in cash. They're adding stadiums that can rival the NFL. They're building, just in my own area, universities are spending tens of millions bringing in and building humongous dormitory complexes and cafeterias that are really more like restaurants than anything else. The amount of money and luxury and excess from these people is extraordinary. There was a study, it's entitled Academically Adrift, Limited Learning in College by Richard Arun and Josipa Roska, I think is their names. They studied 2,300 undergraduates in America's universities, and that goes from Harvard to UCLA to LSU. And, you know, it was a very complicated analysis. They put the students through a number of tests, and here's what they came up with. They were overwhelmingly incapable of writing. They could not put together a serious argument. Number two, about 45% in their, these were graduates, by the way, at the end of their senior year or a few years following, 45% had absolutely no improvement in their thinking, reasoning, or writing at the end of their senior year versus the beginning of their freshman year. They simply weren't educated. Professors had absolutely no accountability for their failures. You could go in and play movies every day. Never work. Give one test or two tests a semester, have a grad student correct it. You don't have to move a muscle, and you're getting paid six figures. No one is going after these people. They don't have to work at all if they don't want to. You might, you know, it might get suspicious after a while, but you can do this and get away with it. These writers, these authors who put together the Academically Adrift study said that the professors are never held accountable for their failures. They institutionally cannot be held accountable for their failures because they have tenure, and importantly, they don't, they're not there to teach. They're there to promote a line. And from a legal and from a moral point of view, it is complete, utter false advertising. These universities are telling parents that you come to us and we'll educate your child. They'll become knowledgeable in such and such a field, and they will be placed very well in the job market. None of it is true. It is false advertising, and in places like Notre Dame or Georgetown, they promote themselves as Catholic universities, and they are as liberal as any secular university out there. That is a particularly nasty form of false advertising, and somebody simply needs to take legal action against these fraudulent institutions. Wall Street Journal has something to say here, too. Another pet peeve of mine is this Ivy League worship. The Ivy Leagues, in my opinion, at least in my field, is no place to get an education. You do not get an education there. Professors do not teach. Graduate school is not about going to classes or listening to lectures. Professors are there to talk about their own particular area of research, not the field in general. It's all affirmative action. I believe Harvard and Yale are about 40% Jewish, if not higher, and they're 2% of the population. So there's a lot of ethnic networking. But a lot of people think that, you know, you go to an Ivy League school and you get a better education than if you go to the University of Maine. And the opposite is probably the case, because standards of scholarship in the classroom are not up to the university. The university has very little control over that. It's up to the professor. So you can go to Dartmouth and get, you know, a group of relatively easy professors. You can go to the University of Rhode Island and get a group of very difficult professors. It doesn't mean anything. It's to a great extent a scam. And a lot of people believe that if you go to an Ivy League school, there's a much better chance of getting a job than if you went to something else. And yet the Wall Street Journal reports that the top schools for company hiring are Penn State, Texas A&M, University of Illinois, Purdue, Arizona State, Michigan, Georgia Tech, Maryland, Florida, Carnegie Mellon, Brigham Young, Ohio State, and one Ivy League, Cornell, which is number 14. MIT is number 23. So it's kind of, there's a lot of social manipulation here. The major Ivy League schools are not even on this list in terms of company hiring in your basic sciences, in business and sort of the non-academic topics like accounting and everything else in the job market coming from these institutions. And Penn State comes up again and again and again as the place to go because they just companies, for whatever reason, recruit very heavily from there. Now, I want to conclude this, and I know that really what I've been talking about for the last 40 minutes is the question of, first of all, knowledge as a practical matter, you know, how we go about studying and learning things and then promoting them, but also how this impacts the very nature of the debate itself and how people can be harmed very seriously. And, of course, that immediately leads into the academics, because they distort and poison the debate for a living, and it's quite a living. Now, a lot of you probably don't know, even those of you who read St. Augustine, that he wrote a book called Against the Academics. We were talking in the very early Middle Ages. St. Augustine is really the nature of the academy at the time. The academy at the time was largely dedicated to skepticism. Now, I don't believe that the regime and the left and the liberals and the academics, I don't believe that they're relativists. That's not true. Relativism is a weapon, and they use relativism as a weapon to attack students that come in as maybe religious. They come in as conservative types of one kind or another, and then they use relativism to dissolve that. And then they put their own absolutes on these kids. The left has never believed in relativism unless it's in their interest for the moment. You just bring up the Jewish Holocaust and see how relativistic they really are. It really doesn't take much to see the absolutes try to deny the equality of races or continents, civilizations. You'll see that they are the very opposite of relativists. They are immensely dogmatic. They're far more dogmatic than any Christian man I've ever come across. But Augustine's small book, Contra Academicus, or Against the Academics, is against the concept of skepticism, or this idea that we've already been talking about relative to Plato, the sophists, and their rejection of there being any truth. It's not truth, it's power. Power is all that matters. There is no truth because nature is not a source of knowledge. Nature is a void, it's a flux. We impose our will upon it. That's very, very common in modern thought. This, of course, is early medieval. And so St. Augustine is saying here that the academy of his day was mostly Greek materialist skepticism. Of course, you can't be a skeptic and a materialist at the same time, because materialism is, in fact, a dogma. It's a doctrine. Now, Augustine says, first of all, that happiness is based on the activity, and then eventually that apprehension of truth with a capital T, something that informs all other truths and makes them true. It's stable, it's unchanging, and it makes you happy because you have this drive, you have this desire. Those few people who are dedicated to coming to the truth of the matter, no matter what happens to them, and no matter who they have to hurt in the process, because lots of people get hurt. If you go to a deluded person or somebody who has invented their own little world, and you go burst that bubble with facts, you better be armed. And I don't care how nice you are in doing it. You burst that bubble. You force that cognitive conflict, like two tidal waves hitting each other in their minds. You know, I mean, these people can go into breakdown. These people will go after you physically. It's happened to me. It's happened to a lot of you. I'm not talking about that. This kind of mental illness is based on this belief that how you are brainwashed is, you know, that's actually how it is. That's what the truth is. You know, modernity is based on this idea that nature is dead. It's just a flux. And then the elite impose their will upon it. But our desire, those few people who have this overwhelming platonic desire, this erotic desire, as Plato puts it in the Symposium, to come to the truth no matter what, you will lose friends. You will be attacked personally, emotionally, and physically, because all you're doing is going around bursting people's bubbles, and that bubble is the only thing that's keeping them together. And when you go doing it, you better be very, very careful how you handle it. Education is not this endless search. You see that in every ridiculous, stupid college pamphlet that they give to the parents. It's the journey that matters. What's the point of all this if, first of all, there is no end? There is no truth. We wouldn't even know it if we came across it. It's this endless journey. And then, of course, we drop dead. Education is not an endless search. It is a way to peel the layers of delusion and power from the truth. So St. Augustine has this concept that if you, it's a little bit like, it's a much better, more complicated version of Mill's famous argument that people are completely irrational. They don't care about the truth. In general, they care about what makes them happy or what they think makes them happy. Falsehood can never make you happy. It only makes the regime happy. Our job, says St. Augustine, is to peel away those accretions of power and domination that falsehood and this kind of self-interest has placed on what otherwise could be approached as truth. It's a matter of will, not necessarily of intellect. The academics of his day were obsessed with appearance, as they are today. They're obsessed with being considered these extraordinary, prestigious people that deserve these six-figure salaries, and they don't have to answer for anything because you are beneath them. They're sophists. They don't care about truth. They don't believe in truth. Truth is not in their interest, and therefore all that exists is power, which is just another way of saying all that exists is them. The ancient concept of skepticism, that there really is no knowledge of that which is external, and really the only thing that matters is consciousness. It's how you're approaching things rather than the things themselves. But the problem, and St. Augustine is very clear here, the problem is that that means that they can manipulate things into however they want. So now we've come full circle. The very beginning of today's talk, which was, you know, unusual for me, and how I deal with this, people will listen to you talk, including this own talk that I'm doing now. They'll read something, and they will pick out those handful of things that interest them. They will then remake them and reprocess them in their own mind. And then when you talk to them about it, you're talking about their approach to things, not what's in the book or what's on the radio. But that's the problem. That's the problem that I began this talk with, this idea that people, number one, have no right to opinions on these things that they don't know anything about. And number two, when they do start spouting off on this stuff, it's all about self-interest. What makes them feel smart? What makes them happy? What makes them this? What makes them that? And St. Augustine is talking about the ancient skeptical school, and they held that no knowledge of the external world is really possible in any stable sense. But what that means in practice is that they can manipulate this flux of the outside world, and they can then invent reality. And Augustine, in an amazing clinical way, can say that this is the origin of mental illness. The origin of mental illness is based on conceptual conflict. The idea that you are confronted by truth, but you hold in your own mind that there is no such thing, and therefore what is out there confronting you as truth has to be in somehow, some sense, somehow destroyed. And what these academics do, and Augustine is talking about them, no different than what we're talking about today, St. Augustine is saying that the academy is there to tell students what is real and what is not. And what is real is what they have created because they don't believe, at least they don't publicly believe, that there is any such thing as human nature or the external nature in our world and our environment. There is this flux, but in claiming that it's like Nietzsche says this, Heraclius says this, there's a long school of thought that says that nature is just flux and we impose our will upon it. The problem is that these people then claim that they have the right and even the responsibility to impose their will on nature and therefore on human nature. Well, St. Augustine is talking about academics and, you know, philosophical discussion in the early Middle Ages, the fall of the Western Roman Empire, and he's talking no differently than I have been over the last 50 minutes. So I've run out of time. I thank you for listening, and I appreciate you supporting the show or even listening to this solely for the sake of criticizing it. I appreciate it. I appreciate your support. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned in to Radio Aryan.